Real News, joined yet again, third time now, Tony Gosling, and we're both dressed in red like some communists here. This is a really cool interview. I'm really glad that he wants to talk about this subject because I think it's fascinating. World War II, I forget the exact quote, but people talk about more changes during wartime in a day or a year or whatever it is than 100 or 1,000 years during normal time. And World War II really set up the present world that we have today and gives us a lot of the institutions that we take for granted as well. And we're going to get into that. We're going to get into World War II, its implications, Martin Bormann, what's going on. First and foremost, though, I wear red because red's my favorite color. I love red. It's something that I love. But you've got an interesting shirt on there. It looks like it's Jesus on the front. Can you tell us about your shirt?
It's actually a design that I pinched from a work colleague. I think it would be around about 2001. I was working for the Chrysalis Empire, which is a media empire. And we were doing basically like investigative websites. There were five or six around the country, one in Oxford, one in London, Birmingham, Bristol. And I was employed as an editor, and I had quite a few staff. I had a nice commissioning budget for artwork and that sort of thing. And the whole organisation was torpedoed by a legal action. And we knew why. It's because the media, that sort of mass media, has got to be controlled. And what we were doing was... Anyway, so let me just make sure we're not being interrupted by silly noises and things. The woman that was working up in Birmingham, she'd just finished working doing the press for the Church of England in Birmingham, and they'd used this design as an advert hoarding, which was all over the city one Easter, in order to get people to go along to church at Easter, saying, I think that the slogan underneath was
Jesus as Che Guevara would entice more people to go to church? What?
Well, you know what? It's been underneath on the advertising hoardings. We're talking about massive. I've still got, I think, one or two of the big hoardings they put up.
There's an entire documentary with a single photograph of him that's been memorialized in T-shirts. So it is a very iconic thing. Is that part of the reason that they chose that for the branding?
She's just doing the PR for them, and she thought it'd be a good idea, so she commissioned a bit of artwork, and it's a great, I think, I like it. But it said underneath, it said, meek, mild, as if, right? So meek, mild, full stop, as if, and then come to church at Easter and get the message, right? Because, of course, you know, the message of Easter is a very powerful one. It's about, you know, someone who is subverting the establishment by pointing out and effectively satirizing them, really, what the establishment did to the guy at Passover 2000 or whatever years ago, you know. So anyway, so that's where I got the design from. I just loved it, and hopefully it's still out there, out and about there somewhere. But look, talking about the Second World War, you can't really, or you can go straight in and talk about it, but the real thing that we as journalists have got to do, and one thing they hate us doing, and we've seen this during the whole COVID-19 business, is to contextualize and to explain, you know, to take a step back from these individual stories and to show the pattern of events. And let me tell you, the establishment hate that. The big pharma hate that. The Bilderbergers hate that more than anything, because they want you to see things their way. They do the dot joining, right? And the idea is that we're joining some dots for you. You have to wear a face mask, you know, blah, blah. And that's why. But they're joining the dots all in the wrong order, right? So you end up not seeing what the picture is really about. So here's one thing about World War II. And there's a lot of intellectual looking articles out there, several explaining why there is no plan over hundreds of years to use world wars to control the planet, right? Well, let me tell you, there is a plan. And it's a plan many people in the Middle East understand. We never get any coverage of it over here, in the same way as we don't get coverage of Bilderberg. And we might want to talk about that a bit, the fact that there's been supposedly...
Oh, we're definitely going to talk about that. And anybody that's not aware, We're also going to be asking a veteran journalist right now, is Hitler still alive? So we're going to want to stay tuned for that, too. I'm going to put him on the, not really put him on the spot, because I've already asked him a question, so there's plenty of time to prepare. But we're going to get into that afterwards. But I think let's take even – I love what you're doing, and taking a step back is very important. And there's a lot of people that watch the, my videos, which are right there with you, you know, and they know, and they know what's going on. They've deeply researched a lot of these subjects. A lot of people are coming to this brand new. So let's paint the, because when you talk about the fact that that's a very big statement that you said right there. Wars are made to control human beings, and they're planned. So can you give a little evidence to support that, and then get into painting the background for the story, Hitler, Martin Bormann. Let's paint the background just even so it's accessible to the average viewer.
Of course, right. I mean, it's not just war, it's also obviously revolutions. And I would say one of the first was the English Revolution. We had a, basically it was, people talk about it as a revolution. It wasn't really a revolution. It was a civil war between two major factions, the up and coming capitalist faction, the merchant class faction, which was based around the city states, like the big cities like Bristol, York, London, the city of London particularly, versus the old feudal class, the landowning class. So it was basically, it was the merchants coming along, kicking out the feudal leaders, in this case, the king, and saying, right, we've had enough of that. So that was in the 1640s. Also worth mentioning that Cromwell had a very difficult job to do in those days, and that was to get rid of the king, because he knew that the king was under arrest, and he knew that if the king was allowed to survive, the king would expose him and his wicked role and his criminality. So he had to kill the king, because he knew that if he didn't, the king would have him killed. So this basically assassination, judicial assassination, had to be organized by Cromwell in a very sneaky, secret way. And he got his son, his nephew, Henry Ireton, who was a soldier, to do something called Pride's Purge, which was to go into Parliament and arrest all the people, all the members of Parliament that supported negotiating with the king. So that all there was left was the people that wanted rid of the king. Then they had a vote, of course, to prosecute the king. And that ended up with the execution of Charles I. And that was it. The merchant classes were now in control of the country. So this didn't just happen because, oh, Charles I was a bad ruler. It happened because the merchants were particularly doing very well on privatizing land, enclosing land, kicking the peasants off the land, our ancestors, you know, off the land who'd been there since time immemorial, you know, just basically farming on these big allotments of land, producing food to feed their own families, self-sufficient effectively. And they did that in order to get them to go into the new factories which were coming up. You know, the Industrial Revolution was about to start. They wanted these people as landless laborers, but they had land, so they had to boot them off the land. Charles stopped that, right? And of course, all the merchant classes then say, crikey, we need to get rid of this king, because he was stopping the enclosures. That was what they were called, the privatization of land. So that's just one example. It's not a world war, but it's a very effective and efficient revolution where the merchants take over. And also, I would suggest, this is one of the origins of Freemasonry, because the Freemasons only came out into the open in the 1700s, sort of 1717 in England. Beforehand, Cromwell had used Masonic tactics to get his little secret group together to take over Parliament. And he used Solomon's Temple, the same imagery as Freemasonry uses. So anyway, just to get back to the, 200 years after that, you guys in the USA, you had your Civil War. And Albert Pike was one of these, I think he was a captain in the Confederate Army.
Brigadier General.
Well, okay, so, yeah, he may have worked his way up somehow. But anyway, he's also one of the creators.
And the point is, they're tearing statues down all across the world, but we have a Confederate, not a Union, a Confederate Brigadier General who has a statue north of the Mason-Dixon line in Washington, D.C., our nation capital. Nobody thinks about tearing that one down, but please continue.
Yeah, because we've had a load of stuff in the news the last few days about people in Bristol tearing down the statue and throwing it in the harbour of Edward Colston, the slave trader, who's a merchant venturer. As I was saying, the city-states, the merchants, these guys, and they're still around today, the merchant venturers. They're a society. The money that Colston made has been invested over the hundreds of years. Now that money is in, well, we don't know where. We're not allowed to know where that money is because
I'm sorry, you're talking about the Civil War before I interrupted you. So
yeah, but I mean, I draw the connections with today a bit. You know, you're talking about statues coming down. But so the merchant venturers here in Bristol today have massive amounts of money, but we're not allowed to know where it is. If it was an ordinary company, it would have to file accounts at Company's House, but it's not. It's constituted under a royal charter, right, from the 1500s. So they don't have to put their accounts at Company's House. They're overlooked by the Privy Council, which is directly overseen by the monarchy, right? So you've got to be a Privy Councillor, and you've got to institute an inquiry into the merchant venturers. If you want to find out where this money is today, I can tell you where most of it is. It's in shares in privatised utilities. So that's every drop of water we drink, they have their cut. Every bit of electricity we use, they have their cut. Every bit of gas, you know, that the transport systems, they're getting a bit of all of it. These are all the things that in Britain used to be nationalised, and that the any profits from them went to the public purse, but they're not anymore. So that's our own Bristol version. And I would, yeah, getting back to Pike, his plan for three world wars, I think, I mean, there are other revolutions, but, you know, the US Civil War was ostensibly about slavery, and that, of course, was a major issue at the time. But the actual result of it and the purpose of the war, I believe, looking at it from across the pond, was just consolidation of power. The idea that the states, the individual states, can make their own mind up about things was out of the window. At the end of the Civil War in the US, people thought, well, look, we can't have the states being too independent. We need to consolidate more power in Washington. And that was the end result of the American Civil War. More consolidation of power. We had the same with the English Civil War. But anyway, the Albert Pike's plan for three world wars, and obviously World War II fits in very importantly with that, was the First World War would be basically to turn Russia communist, which happened, and the Second World War to turn China communist, which happened. But there were also other big geopolitical changes during these war times that he planned. Now, I'm not saying that everybody is aware that he's fighting this war. Even the generals, not necessarily aware of the plan, but those behind the wars, I believe, have been planning these things. So the major thing in the First World War...
I'm just going to interrupt you. I'm sorry, but we have books from Anthony Sutton, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler. We have Tragedy and Hope, the Anglo-American Establishment. If without the Rockefellers, without Standard Oil, without IBM, people don't realize that Coca-Cola couldn't sell any Coke to not to Germany, so they said, hey, let's make Fanta. So every time you drink Fanta, you're drinking a Nazi drink. People don't realize, I think it was Reebok and Adidas or Puma, the brothers split because they were like, you're not Nazi enough for me. And so we're still living with the implications of that, but continue.
So for an example, in Sweden, the Wallenberg brothers, one of them was pro-Nazi, the other one was pro-Allies. The idea being that, you know, for most rich people, they want to have their eggs in both baskets. You know, they want to have a few different, whoever wins. A good example is Royal Dutch Shell. You know, the company, which was a very powerful oil company in Holland, it made sure that it had its assets both controlled by the Nazis under occupation and also by directors and shareholders who were outside the country, actually mainly the royal family, who were moved to Canada, I think, that they stayed in. So anyway, but the purpose of the First World War was really about the British Empire getting control of the Holy Land. So that was the main actual purpose of it, behind the scenes, the smashing of the Ottoman Empire in the First World War, and of course
Tony, because you're so cool and so much smarter than me too, but anybody that reads the Balfour Declaration, it says, Dear Lord Rothschild, and you know, we're asking the Rothschilds here, and I believe it was Lord Chamberlain that addressed him. But continue. I'm sorry. I'm going to shut up for now. I've had way too much coffee today.
The Balfour Declaration is Walter Rothschild's letter, really. And Balfour himself made this, you know, he sent the letter saying we will, basically this was during the First World War, he's saying, well, we want to create a Jewish state in Palestine. But this was the quid pro quo to get, because basically Britain was about to lose the First World War in 1916. And in order to continue and to try and beat Germany, which they failed, the deal was, if you sign this Balfour Declaration, we will get the Americans over and get them to help you in the First World War. So that's what happened. And the declaration was made in 1916 and 17. And then in the Second World War, of course, it actually came true. It all took place. But this is largely because what happened in Nazi Germany is they basically divided the Jews into the pro-Zionist Jews and the other Jews, and most of the other Jews were rounded up, but the pro-Zionist ones were persuaded and cajoled to go to Palestine, and which was then Palestine, which then became Israel. So there was an operation basically over those two first and Second World Wars to create this basically a crusader state. Now this is a Templar agenda. This is an agenda that goes back even further, right? This is back to the Middle Ages, to the Crusades.
I'm sorry, I'm interrupting you so much. But was this state to create this friction for the potential Albert Pike Third? What was the reason they tried with these wars to create this Israeli state in Palestine?
Okay, so go back to the Templars in the medieval times. Okay, so the Knights Templar were the first ever multinational bankers. They were basically a satanic cult that got outed, particularly by the King of France. The King of France had loads of them arrested. And then, and this is what many people, if you look into the and research it, you'll find there was a great grudge by the Templars and by the occultists and the most evil groups on the planet against the French. Hence the bloodiness of the French Revolution. They swore that every single person who was descended from the French king and those that helped him arrest the Templars back in 1307 would die in the 1700s in the revolution. So that's why so many aristocrats in France were murdered and guillotined. This was a vengeance for the Templar king, for King Philip the Fair, getting rid of the Templars. But who were the Templars? Well, basically they were Satanists pretending to be Christians. And it was all part of the battle between the two churches. So you had the Eastern Church, what is now the Orthodox Church, which was based in Constantinople. And you had the Roman Church, what's now called the Catholic Church, based in Rome. And they were battling away with each other. Basically, they had a thing called the Great Schism. I think it was 1054, where the two churches split. They started fighting each other. And this was the swan song of the Vatican, basically, to send all these soldiers over, supposedly heading for the Holy Land. But what did they do? Oh, they decided they wanted to surround and besiege Constantinople, some fellow Christians, right? So they're trying to supposedly have a war with the Muslims, the infidels, over in the Holy Land. But actually, the real war was against the old Orthodox Church. And this was an attempt by the Vatican to basically take over, monopolize Christianity. And they failed, basically, because the Orthodox Church is still hanging around. But anyway, so this is the purpose, I think. I mean, looking at it now, of Israel now, is because they failed the first time to take over the Holy Land, the Templars are at it again. The same idealism, which is effectively, I mean, this is what actually Pike talks about, the nihilists. He talks about in his letters the nihilists and the atheists, right? So the atheists are the Russian communists and the Chinese communists. In fact, we've seen this formally now with President Xi, saying that if you say President Xi is saying the wrong thing and he doesn't know what he's talking about, you're in jail, right? So this is similar to the infallibility of the Pope, for example, right? So that's an atheistic system they've now got, which is not about free speech. It's not about, you know, rights for the workers or anything anymore. It's about, you know, you've got a leader whose word is law, you know? He's like Judge Dredd, President Xi, and also he's in there for life, by the way. You can't get rid of him now. He's managed to change things. In Hong Kong, they're getting very frightened because they've had a basic free speech there for many, many years. They've had all sorts of newspapers and books written about, you know, intrigue and scandals going on within the Chinese Communist Party in Beijing. And it's one of the nice things about Hong Kong is you've got all this scandal there, you know. Gosh, it's like reading what we call in Britain Private Eye, which is a scandal sheet in London. And you've had that for many years, but not under President Xi. This is all getting very serious. And if you laugh, for example, during the Chinese national anthem in China or Hong Kong now, again, you can be arrested for laughing at the national anthem. So that's the militant atheist attitude that there is now. Obviously, Russia is another case, right? Because that should have stayed, supposedly stayed communist or gone capitalist, but it didn't. It's gone off in its own direction. And Putin, we've got to thank for that, because he double-crossed the oligarchs back in 2000 when he became president. The oligarchs thought, oh, he's going to be our little poodle puppet president. First thing he did is he turned the tables on Berezovsky, who was the chief oligarch who owned NTV, the big TV channel, the Mercedes franchise and various other things. You know, they were basically, the whole country over 10 years between 1990 and 2000 was just raped. Literally, financially, everything was taken by these oligarchs with borrowed money from Switzerland and sold off to the world stock markets for peanuts. But Putin stopped all that in, well, not all of it, but most of it in 2000 by turning the tables on this oligarchy. So if we're looking at these world wars, so you've got the First World War doing its job, which is, okay, so causing absolute horrors and massacre in Belgium, in France, of British, of Belgian, of French people, of Germans in the trenches. But the ultimate gain was down in the Middle East. That was really the ultimate purpose of that war. And remember, of course, it was started by, and it was organized by three cousins. It was Tsar Nicholas of Russia. It was Kaiser Wilhelm, and it was the British King. They were all three cousins. So effectively, the First World War was rather like, we can easily look back on it now, it was like a family squabble, you know, that had gone a bit too far. And anyway, so then we had the Second World War. The Second World War, which was the idea there was to, first of all, to create the situation in Europe where they were going to attempt, anyway, to unite Europe under one control afterwards, which they did. And hopefully if Brexit succeeds, they will fail there. But the main thing, of course, was the creation of the State of Israel. And many people don't realize the very important events that took place when the Israeli state got its vote at the United Nations. The brand new United Nations had to vote, yes, Israel should become its own country. And David Ben-Gurion, who was the first prime minister there, he was negotiating to try and get this vote through to create the State of Israel, 1947. And he was having real trouble because most of the world was saying, well, this is just going to cause a load of trouble, isn't it, if we have an Israeli state there. But you know who came to his rescue? It was Nelson Rockefeller, good old Nelson Rockefeller, who he had a very important role with the South American, the Latin American countries, controlling and running a lot of the American embassies down there. And he did a deal, basically, with Ben-Gurion. And he said, well, look, I can deliver all these Latin American countries to vote for you, but only if you forget any idea of pursuing any Nazi war criminals, because we in America want those Nazi war criminals. We want them to help us to fight the Cold War with the Soviet Union, which is coming on the horizon. So let's do a little deal, and I'll make sure you get your Latin American votes, Ben-Gurion. And that's why we got a State of Israel in 1947, is because had done a deal in order to get those Latin American votes. And, of course, the quid pro quo for all of that was that the Mossad and all of the Israeli intelligence arms, including their newspapers, their government, were never going to pursue Nazi war criminals, which is, of course, a crime in itself. It was left to a handful of journalists, people like the Hungarian Ladislas Farago. I think it was John Ware, World in Action, which was an investigative TV program in Britain in the 1970s to go hunting for these war criminals in Latin America, mainly in Argentina and Paraguay, and for people like Martin Bormann. So there you have it. The Third World War, according to Albert Pike, is going to be, effectively, it's going to be the Zionists who he calls the nihilists, and the reason he calls them that is because they aren't Jews, they're not Christians. These people are just selfish lunatics who are quite happy to use the whatever word you want in order to get some sort of credibility. So people like Benjamin Netanyahu, you know, talking about the Old Testament, and he will talk about anything as long as it gets him his way. He's not really interested in, you know, the Sermon on the Mount. Well, of course he's not, because he's Jewish supposedly, but he's not interested in the Ten Commandments. Neither is Tony Blair interested in the Sermon on the Mount. These people are just using religion to get their aims, and that's why Pike calls them the nihilists, is because they will do and say absolutely anything to get their way. So that's where we're heading now. I think it's a war between Iran and the Muslim countries like Syria, Lebanon, Hezbollah in the Middle East, and there are many others, of course, around that part of the world, and the Zionist Christians, the Zionist Jews. And, you know, the idea really is here to drag in America, which is already, of course, down there. The Russians are already down there, by the way. So if a war starts, you're not going to be long before Americans start shooting Russian planes down and vice versa. And once that starts getting going, it's going to be maybe like the First World War and the Second World War, Will, where after maybe, I don't know, however many months, or who knows how fast it will go, but then suddenly China will need to be involved, because the Chinese will come in backing up the Russians, and they have stated as they want to see East Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine, as an independent state. That's what the Chinese want. So you've got it all really ready to go, all set up. Albert Pike's World War Number 3 is raring to go, and we're starting to get all the signs that the domestic population here in the West is now being corralled and controlled to make sure that we don't get civil society here in the West and free speech able to bring about the sorts of demonstrations that we saw in the beginning of the Iraq War in London. 2 million people, the biggest demonstration we've ever seen in Britain, saying, no, we don't want an Iraq War. But that, they hope, won't happen. It won't be allowed to happen, because civic society is being controlled with all sorts of, first of all, bias in the press and censorship, and secondly, through the destruction of these civil society groups, the infiltration of groups like the Stop the War movement, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, all the sorts of people that the groups that brought people out onto the streets in 2003 are all being undermined in an attempt to stop civil society organising against such a future war. And we're getting so much bias and propaganda. The idea is obvious to me that we've got to be behind Israel. We will be in Britain behind Israel, won't we? They're so like us. They're part of the European Union, pretty much, people think, even though, of course, they're not in Europe.
They're a democracy in the Middle East. You have to support them.
Well, okay, so there's your world wars. And that's what I think is the context to what we're about to talk about World War II, because very important. I mean, the evidence that I've dug up and others, you know, I'm a bit of a dot joiner and a jigsaw put together. And I'm much more interested in doing that. And trying to make sense of what seems like crazy things. The crazy things are, for example, Ian Fleming. Everyone knows Ian Fleming. He's the author of the Bond novels, the Bond films. Actually, the films are better than the novels, I would suggest, having read some of the novels. They're not, you know, not so pacey, but the films were really well made, mostly, certainly the early ones. And what they do is they show a kind of statecraft in a way that the mass media never shows us. Things going on behind the scenes. Most of the time, Fleming is obsessed, beautifully obsessed, with this idea that there's hidden hands behind the scenes trying to get the big powers fighting each other for their own personal benefit, you know. And, of course, this is one way to win a war. You get two. If you've got opposition, you get your opposition fighting each other, and then you come out the victory. You haven't even lifted a finger. It's the same way that we get elites getting black communities to fight white communities in poor districts and dividing white and black in New York, in Bristol, in London. You know, the idea of getting race wars going is simply so that the rich can just sit, watch and rub their hands, and they win without actually lifting a finger. All they've done is they've used psychological warfare to set people against each other. So, yeah, I'm happy to talk about a bit about World War II and what was really going on there, because I think there were some fascinating connections behind the scenes between the two key figures were Adolf Hitler's private secretary, Martin Bormann, and Winston Churchill's private secretary, Major Desmond Morton.
So let's talk about that, because even before that, we have a relationship, like you brought up, I mean, even more than you brought up, with the royals in England and people within Germany. And then we also have the fact that, you know, Hitler and Martin Bormann is somebody that has pretty much unparalleled power. He controls who's talking. And, you know, people don't stop and think to realize that, hey, the Nazis were in communication with these guys, or personal secretaries. It's not as, like, good and bad as we like to reminisce upon World War II.
Well, no, I mean, yeah, it seems pretty clear to me. Obviously, what they did was they created Wall Street and the City of London. I mean, Montagu Norman, who's the governor of the Bank of England, was a complete maniac, complete maniac. You had, I think it was Henry Morgenthau in the US, who was much more level-headed, and he could see just how awful the fascists were in Germany. But our governor of the Bank of England didn't do any of that. He was just like, well, I'll tell you what, let's give all that money. You know, Hitler's just invaded Czechoslovakia. Let's hand him all of the money from the Czechs' bank deposits of gold in the Bank of England straight to Adolf. Yeah, because without question. So, you know, someone invades someone else. Right, well, that's yours now, isn't it? Here's a trainload of gold for you. So he was being very cooperative. And, of course, this is all around the time of the controversial Bank for International Settlements activities, and they were created out of the Versailles Treaty. After the Second World War, there was an attempt to shut them down, but they're still going strong, very connected up with Bilderberg. They're their own country. The Swiss police, where they're based in Basel, are not allowed into the land that the Bank for International Settlements is on. And they are the central banker's central bank. I mean, they really are. We had our previous Governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, was their head of regulation, right? So he's the imbecile that allowed the entire bad regulation in the banking markets to allow the 2008 financial bailouts to happen and the crisis, etc., which is basically just a robbery by the banks of all the governments that have been stupid enough not to control and regulate their banks well enough. In fact, obviously, that goes for today as well. But look, I mean, getting back to the Second World War and those people involved, it becomes pretty clear that there, once communist Russia was going, we had the same sorts of fears that had been around during the times of Napoleon and previously, where there was just a complete like paranoia basically in the Western elites about the Russians. And this time it was with the Bolsheviks and their ideas. They were saying, well, actually the workers need more power. Now this was obviously a threat. And they saw it as a conspiracy to slowly take over through Marxist parties. And perhaps they were slightly right about that. And it would have brought some more social justice if workers had had more power in Europe. So they set basically Wall Street and the Bank of England and the City of London, particularly the city and the big investors, wanted an Adolf Hitler as a buffer against Russia. So the idea is that if we've got Hitler and Russia fighting away down there, we would be fine, you know. So that's how they created Hitler. And you mentioned, I think, Anthony Sutton and his series of books, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, very, very important book, absolutely crucial. Let's see documentaries about that every night on our television. And, well, of course, we don't. But they're out there. There is some very good analysis, and the book is there itself. And, of course, he also wrote about Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. So, you know, these things were created by bankers with spare cash investment funds. And so that's how it happened. And then it was inevitable, really. I don't think Stalin was in on it, but that Nazi Germany was going to throw itself against. I mean, Hitler was completely insane to do it, but maybe that's why he was put in power in the first place, because he was easy to manipulate against Russia in Barbarossa, in Operation Barbarossa in 1941. And I remember reading recently, I think it was in one of William Stevenson's books, maybe The Bormann Brotherhood, because he's written a couple of really, I mean, I'll mention a few books in the next, 20 minutes or so, Will, which are really key books in understanding the Second World War. This one is called The Borman Brotherhood. William Stevenson was a Canadian television journalist in the 1950s and 60s who he also wrote, he had some fantastic contacts who knew about what was really going on in the Second World War. And that was one. The other one was called A Man Called Intrepid. And that was about the Churchill-Roosevelt organization, which was called, I think it was called the British Security Cooperation Group. And it was based at the Rockefeller Center in New York. And it was set up well before World War II. So this was, they knew the war was coming. But the idea was America at some point are going to be in the war. So we need to have a back channel right the way through, right the way back. And so that's what A Man Called Intrepid is basically about. And it explains how the British and the Americans cooperated before the war had even started to steal an Enigma machine in Poland. But so that they would always be able, once the war kicked off, they would know how to read all the codes of the German army. So they were cooperating at a massively important level before the war had even, war had even been declared in 1939. They did it by blowing up a truck which was carrying an Enigma machine, the German coding device. And then what they had an old one which was all smashed up that they left in as if, oh, there it is. Oh, what a shame it's all been blown up, right? So the Germans saw it and thought, oh, it must have been blown up in the explosion. But it hadn't been. It had been pinched by the Brits before and the Americans before the explosion that had blown the vehicle up. So they had, right from the word go, they knew exactly the way that the Germans were coding, and they could read pretty much everything right the way through the war, which was obviously extremely helpful and very, very useful. So this cooperation level, that's A Man Called Intrepid, really good, but it also talks about Yugoslavia and the way that Yugoslavia was subverted before the invasion of Russia and for the attack on Russia. So that it would delay a crucial couple of months, so that the Germans had to put loads more troops into Yugoslavia because it all wasn't going their way. And that meant that they couldn't quite get Stalingrad. They couldn't quite get Moscow, and they were bogged down in the winter and they lost the war, right? So they're key little things like that. Even people in the Balkans, in Yugoslavia today don't know about this stuff, but it's all in there. A Man Called Intrepid by William Stevenson. So if we sort of fast forward to how it was that Martin Bormann became Hitler's private secretary, how it was that Hitler trusted him so much, I've done a thing called the Martin Bormann Nazi Gold Timeline, which is slowly but surely I've been adding bits and pieces to it, which include a lot of stuff to do with Nazi atom bomb tests. And people may not realise that, I'm sorry, but the Los Alamos wasn't the first. The Trinity test wasn't the first. In July 1945, the evidence is now really, it's come out literally since 2017. These documents have been released and interviews with witnesses to a Nazi atom bomb test in October 1944, even talking about it. They talk about it as a flower cloud or a mushroom cloud, And that, so they had their own atomic program, which makes perfect sense because all of these atomic scientists, original ones, were Nazis. Okay, so they split the atom first in Berlin, and Frisch and Piles, who designed the first atom bomb in Birmingham in Britain, that one of them was German, the other guy was Austrian. All of these people were, including Klaus Fuchs, were Germans, right? So they were the people who were really understanding how atoms worked and how bombs worked. So it's not surprising that they did it first. It's just that Hitler and Bormann realized, hey guys, this is going to be a really, really useful thing to have at the end of the war in order to bargain with the Americans, to bargain with the British. And that's why all these units, all the sensible units, the SS and people like this, people who are in the know, all surrendered to the Americans. They surrendered to the British troops. Even some of the units came across from the Russian front, stopped fighting the Russians and came over to surrender to us because they knew they'd get possibly just executed if they surrendered to the Russians. But they already knew that at the top levels, the Brits and the Americans were already doing deals with the Nazis. So the big question, Will, is, okay, so we know those deals were done. 1945, at the end of the war, but how far back did they go? And we know that, you know, Wall Street and the city were involved in setting Hitler up in the first place. So how far back did they go? This is, I think, is a fascinating question that we need to answer, even if it's just when we're looking at our war memorials, all these people that died, you know, to what extent and how far back were our leaders, our so-called leaders, cooperating with Hitler, even say, for example, in the weeks after D-Day in 1944. So Bormann came to power because he was born in 1900, and he came to power as Hitler's private secretary. But it's quite clear towards the end of the war and after Stalingrad, Hitler sort of kind of realized he was going to lose, and he didn't do any more of these big speeches to these big rallies. And Bormann was far more powerful than Hitler, actually. The reason I say that is because Hitler only ever gave oral orders. Bormann was his private secretary and wrote all those orders down. And of course, there's an element of interpretation there. Right. So he in exactly the same sort of thing would happen with Winston Churchill and Desmond Morton on the other side. So Churchill would pontificate, Morton would write everything down, and then out the orders would go. And Churchill or Hitler would probably never see those pieces of paper and where they went. So they had a great deal of, you know, they could have an interpretive power. But the evidence is that Bormann was involved in Munich. I'm just looking at my little timeline here. In 1931, 18th of September, Hitler's niece, Jelly Raubel, shot herself at her Munich flat after breaking off what is thought to have been a sexual relationship with Uncle Adolf, right? Martin Bormann subsequently bribed the Munich police detectives, including a guy called Heinrich Müller, who went on to be a chief in the Gestapo, who's investigating her death, not to investigate it, right? As confidants of Hitler, Bormann and Müller are to go on to achieve great things in the Nazi party, right? So if you can get Hitler off a murder charge, all of a sudden, you know, you're going to be his best buddy. And that's what happened. I mean, he looked after these people in the succeeding years and put them into key positions. So the next big thing, I suppose, with Bormann is when Rudolf Hess, who was Hitler's deputy. So this is what happened. You can see it happening. If you look at it in with my eyes, you'll see one by one, all Hitler's mates were gotten rid of. Why one was either assassinated, some were, and or else spun out. Now, it was fascinating what they did to Hess. He was just persuaded that Britain wanted to do a peace deal. And this is just a month or so before the invasion of Russia, right? The Operation Barbarossa. And they said, well, go to the Brits. And, you know, maybe we think there's a fascist faction in Britain. And of course there was, you know, not least of which was the king, ex-king anyway, Edward VIII. Because he basically, his mistress was a Nazi agent, and he'd been over in Lisbon trying to persuade Hitler's ambassador there to bomb London. You know, so they knew that, of course the Nazis knew there were some pro-Nazi Brits. And so he was spun out. Now, literally 2 days later, Martin Bormann then gets the plum job with Hitler. So he's promoted basically into that job. And so that from there on, there are various things that happen. But to cut a long story short, you know, you can go through the timeline. It's at politicsthisweek.wordpress.com, or you can go straight there at thisweek.org.uk to look at the timeline if you're interested to see these things. So towards the end of the war, we have D-Day. It all starts looking bad, doesn't it? Okay, so for Hitler, you've got the Russians coming in from the east, and we now got the Western Front opened up as well, much because Stalin was saying, come on, hurry up, Churchill, Roosevelt. You know, for years and years, he was fighting that battle on his own. Of course, the Russians won the war. Actually, if you look at the number of casualties the Brits and the Americans suffered, it was peanuts compared to the Russian millions. On the 10th of August, 1944, is a very important meeting described by book number three I'll talk about, which is Paul Manning. Now, Paul was an American journalist. He worked for CBS News on the radio through the Second World War. He was based in Europe, and he did from 1942, 43, 44, 45. He was one of the main voices that our grandparents, if they lived in the US, would have heard on the radio describing the progress of the war. So Paul Manning was a really dedicated guy. And after the war, he realized that, you know, what had happened with this deal to protect Nazi war criminals that I mentioned, done with Ben-Gurion and Nelson Rockefeller. And as he saw that, he didn't like it, obviously. He's saying, these Nazi war criminals, we can't do deals like that. These guys have got to go to jail. So he was pursuing particularly Bormann in South America, or he was pursuing others. And then it became clear to him that everyone was saying, well, Bormann's here. And eventually he was working. I mean, this is in the 1980s. His book was published. But we had an amazing event in 1972. Stuart Stephen, who's a son of Jewish emigres during the Second World War, just before the Second World War, they came to Britain. He was the foreign editor of the Daily Express. And the Daily Express, one Saturday in 1972, published Martin Bormann is alive. They actually had a photograph of him in Buenos Aires, and it looked very much like him. You'll find the photograph at thisweek.org.uk if you want to have a look, and you make your own mind up. Is this him 30 years afterwards? You know, so we're talking about 40. He'd be 72 years of age because he was born in 1900. So Stuart Stephen published this in the Daily Express, Martin Bormann alive, massive headline. And as because of this, what we got is an enormous backlash right straight away. But there it was. It was all there. And Paul Manning's book, getting back to Paul, it was really an amazing job at describing the economic war of World War II. So this is the idea that you can just use banks. If you're an evil bankster, you can use your bank to buy up the industry in a country before an invasion. In fact, nowadays, I think they buy up the banks and they don't need to invade. They buy up the industries, they buy up the country using banks, and there's no invasion. It's a different kind of takeover. But back in World War II, they knew which they already owned. The German banks already owned loads of the industries of France. He explains this financial warfare tactic that was being used by the Bundesbank and by Deutsche Bank and, you know, the Nazi bankers in World War II. And then he explains very, very succinctly what happened. So the looted money from the end of the war, Paul Manning explains and details and references fully the way that this money was then laundered through Sullivan and Cromwell's law firm, which was the Dulles Brothers law firm in New York. And then it was used to create 750 companies around the world, mostly in the US and Europe. And the idea here was that these companies would become a kind of Fourth Reich financial network supported by crooked, evil bankers who were backing them. Basically, an enormous financial oligarchy, a kind of mafia post-war that would provide employment and prosperity for all these SS people. One of the most shocking things in Paul Manning's book is he explains, well, they wanted to make sure that nobody thought that these would possibly be Nazi organizations, that they recruited Zionists mainly, but Jewish people particularly, to be sometimes chairman of the board of these organizations. So they would, the public front of these Nazi finance companies would be often Jewish people, particularly Zionist people who were in on the game and in on the plan. So that's a, I think, really devious thing that Paul Manning exposed, which I've never seen anybody else really get to the bottom of. And he did an amazing job. His publisher apparently had his legs broken when the book was published, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, 1983. I think it might have been 1982 that came out. And one of Paul's sons was murdered in New York when the book came out.
Wow.
It's well worth having a look at this stuff. It's, you know, these are the books they really didn't want ever to be published. Now, of course, it's a lot easier. The books will not be published because publishing and general mass media is so much more controlled than it was back in the 1980s. So anyway, the other thing he describes in there is something called the Red House meeting, which took place in Brussels. Now, this is where Bormann organized this, but he didn't go himself. The idea was to basically consolidate all of the big German companies together on this plan for resurgence after World War II as a Fourth Reich. So this Red House meeting took place on Thursday, the 10th of August in Strasbourg at the Red House 1944. So, my estimation is definitely from this date of this Red House meeting onwards, there was absolute mega cooperation between people like Desmond Morton and Martin Bormann, that they knew the war was finished and they knew that they wanted to have prosperity after the war. They knew they wanted these technological achievements such as enriched uranium and, of course, the V2 technology, the ballistic missile technology that the Nazis had developed, possibly all sorts of other stuff. They knew that this was the thing that needed to be done, the deal, and then that they would all get together after the war and fight Soviet Russia. You know, that's what they were saying at the time. And so that's, I think, why, you know, there was this very, very close relationship between Desmond Morton and Martin Bormann. Anyway, so when it gets around to 1945, 11th of January, Ian Fleming, who was part of the Naval Intelligence, British Royal Navy Intelligence Service, he flew to Switzerland under diplomatic cover with a letter from Winston Churchill to try and take over control of Nazi deposits. Well, the Swiss were having none of it, right? Of course, they're saying, this isn't your money, you can't have it. But they did give him the number, the Nazi Party membership number of the name of the person that controlled all the Nazi assets in Switzerland. And that was Martin Bormann's Nazi Party number they gave him.
Wow.
NSDAP 60508. Bormann controlled everything. He was effectively the treasurer for all the looted wealth of the whole of Europe, which had gone into these various Swiss bank accounts, and much of it literally physically in Swiss vaults. We're talking about things like bearer bonds, which Manning talks about a lot, but these are basically like cash, bits of paper, which are share certificates that I can give to you and then you have it. It's a bit like cash. And all this stuff was in Switzerland. And Fleming realised, he took back to London, he's saying, well, look, this Bormann guy is the guy we've got to talk to, you know. And that was what they kind of knew that anyway. But this was just to absolutely confirm and seal the deal to go in and rescue Bormann. And that's what they did. And that's the next book I want to talk about, which is the operation that took place between the 1st and the 11th of May 1945, which was literally the very end of the war. Ian Fleming went in with John Ainsworth Davis, whose pen name was Christopher Crichton. And the book is called OPJB, Operation James Bond, it's short for, and it came out in 1996. And that book really explains how the commandos were all trained in Hayling Island in the south of England in Hampshire. I mean, these were some of the fittest, best trained special forces that ever existed in the world at that time, and they were all sent in to Berlin to aid Martin Bormann coming out. So there's a whole flotilla of canoes that went down the rivers and into the British sector. So it was a long operation. It took them 11 days to get Bormann out, and they were several times confronted by Russian soldiers. But they had Russian speakers and Russian uniforms as part of the crew. So when the Russians confronted them, they'd say things like, I'm under here under the express orders of Marshal Zhukov, you know, in Russian, of course. And if you don't behave yourself, we'll get you into serious trouble. Get back and stand back and I'll shoot, you know. So they had a very clever psychological operation, really, to get any Russians that decided they wanted to stop these people getting Bormann out, got short shrift. And it would be interesting, actually, I'm sure there would be some reports, actually, if you would go to the archives, if they haven't been purged, of Russian soldiers reporting, you know, oh, there's some Russians searching for Nazi war criminals that we came across, you know, on the rivers between the 1st and the 11th of May 1945. So anyway, when he was delivered, Bormann was delivered, they used the Christopher Robin names that he describes in the book. And he was called Piglet. Bormann was. He was delivered to Desmond Morton at a place called Verben, just in the British sector, away from the Russian sector. And literally the next day, I would imagine Morton would have flown Bormann straight to Britain. And see, this is the thing. Paul Manning never got this, right? He published this book in 1983, and the OPJB book only came out in 1996. So he wouldn't have known anything about this side of it. And in fact, his book, it's a big mystery. How did Bormann ever get to South America? And he looks at various possibilities, but now we know how he got there. But he came via Britain, and the Brits got him out. And so incidentally, in this book, Will, there is also there's testimony from Winston Churchill himself and from Lord Mountbatten also saying, yes, you can talk about this once we're dead, you know, basically. John Ainsworth Davies did in the book and explains it. But anyway, so the other interesting thing I've got from another book, which is interesting on the topic, which is Critical Mass by Carter Heydrich, is that it was the same day that Bormann would have been flown back to Britain, that is the 12th of May 1945, that we see the submarine, which had all these Nazi secrets on it, that particularly the enriched uranium, something like 50 tons of the stuff, or was it half a ton of the stuff, which had been enriched during the war in secret places in Nazi Germany. In fact, one of the things I can corroborate is that we had a news story out a couple of years ago where some German guy had found a lump of uranium, took it home and realized it was radioactive, but this had just been sitting around in the dirt. So he proved that there was a Nazi radium enrichment program. He proves it. In fact, he actually got arrested because they said, oh, you know, you're in possession of illegal material. He said, I just picked it up in the woods. You know, what are you talking about? Anyway, they didn't believe him. And eventually, I think they did, because now it's been acknowledged by the German government. There was an uranium enrichment program over there. So anyway, so the submarine that all this stuff is on is chugging across the North Atlantic. It's apparently heading for Japan with two Japanese officers on it. And it was going very slowly, right? So they were deciding which way we're going to go to Japan so we don't get... And they had to go slowly because fuel constraints, very, very slowly. And they wanted to be quiet. They didn't want anyone to find them, especially with all this enriched uranium on board. Anyway, on the 12th of May, the submarine surfaces, and I would imagine the two bodies of the Japanese guys were thrown out. They either killed themselves or were shot by the German officers. And submarine then rendezvoused with a U.S. destroyer, the USS Sutton. Uh-huh. And they started chugging over to Portland. I believe it's Portland, Maine, is it? I'm not sure anyway. Some big naval base where the uranium was offloaded and then obviously sent up to the Manhattan Project people and used in, I believe there would be plutonium involved in that as well because they knew how to use an atomic pile to create plutonium. So that's why, you know, we had the two atomic bombs, some of that uranium, some of that plutonium would most definitely be from Nazi Germany. And the other thing that the Germans had that we, you know, the Brits and the Americans didn't have was a way of exploding a plutonium bomb. Okay, so the plutonium is very difficult to make it go bang. The uranium was much easier, the U-235. You use a kind of bullet method where you shoot one bit of uranium into another, it reaches critical mass and it goes bang. But the plutonium, you had to get it much quicker to get to critical mass. So the way they figured to do it was you've got to use a sphere, a hollow sphere, and then you've got to use explosives to crush it. But how do you get all those explosives to trigger all at the same time all around the sphere? Well, the Nazis had worked out how to do that with infrared fuses. So it was a light, basically they used infrared light down little fiber optic type tubes to the explosive trigger to make sure that all these explosives all went off at the same time. And those were also in the submarine, and those or copies of them made by the Manhattan Project were used in the plutonium bomb. I believe it was the second one they used at Nagasaki, rather than, I think the uranium bomb was the first. I'm not absolutely sure which order they went in, but anyway, so you know, Bormann's role in this was absolutely key, as you can see. And there was a lot of looking for him after the war, even though the Israelis didn't want to. I mean, what we had was the Mossad pursuing Adolf Eichmann, the so-called boss of the Final Solution. And they brought him back to Israel and they tried him. Because I think many people were worrying and saying, well, look, you know, why aren't the Israelis doing anything? These guys are all running around South America. What's the Mossad for if it's not going to round these guys up? So they did it. But if you look at the documents, it's absolutely clear that the main person pushing for the extermination of Jews was Martin Bormann, none other than Bormann. You can see, if you're looking at the documents, he's constantly pushing for more Jews to be exterminated. He organized this thing called the Wannsee Conference. which was where the final solution was signed off. He wasn't there himself because he knew, you know, this is a hot potato. I want to actually keep away. A bit like the Red House meeting, the same thing. He organises these conferences where he knows that what the outcome's going to be. It's all been prearranged. But he himself stays away to try and keep his hands clean because he knows he may be on the run after the war. He certainly, I think, was a kind of gangster. He had no real belief in the Nazi Party. He was just there to make money and, you know, to survive the war and do as well as he possibly could out of it. And I think he did do quite well out of it, actually. So there is a whole load of publications after the war of these various books I've mentioned. But I think it's also interesting to look at Ian Fleming and his films. I mean, Moonraker was published in 1955 in April. It's the Bond novel with some of the strongest hints at collaboration between the transatlantic powers and the Nazis, particularly rocket science, right? He's hinting. He's saying in there, look, I don't want to be arrested under the Official Secrets Act, right? And, of course, this is the same problem that John Ainsworth Davis faced, right? He can't write Op JB because it's all official secrets. That's why he used the pen name Christopher Crichton. So Fleming, what he did, in fact, he was an alcoholic after the war. He was starting to drink a lot because he was sick to see what had happened. You know, we basically sold everything. The way they tricked everybody to get involved in Op JB, sorry, I missed this bit out really, skipped over it, is they said, this is Churchill and Morton, right? They said to the commandos who were going over there, they said, well, look, guys, what we need to do is to get all the money from the war. We know it's in Switzerland. We'll bring it back to Britain then when we'll share it out amongst all the European countries and they can all have their money back. And everyone's thinking, oh, it's a great idea. And most of these commandos thought that's what they were doing. But when they finally got Bormann back, the signature of all these bank accounts and the guy that would transfer the money from Switzerland to whoever, they did none of that, right? They just used it for themselves. And they did deals with Bormann and nobody got any of their money back. In fact, the guy that was in charge, I've met his granddaughter, of training commandos. He was the head of UK coastal forces in the south of England, around Hayling Island. It was called HMS Northney. Was its code? Well, it wasn't a code name. It was it was basically a ground base, a stone frigate they call it, basically, which means it's not a ship. HMS, and it's a land base. He was in command of the training of all the commandos, right? So. He obviously realised what his commandos were being used for. You know, Churchill or the army and the navy leaders and Fleming would have told him. But then after the war, he realised, well, hang on a minute. What's happened to all this money? I thought you were supposed to be sharing it all out. Anyway, you know what happened to him? He died in mysterious circumstances about 2 or 3 months after the end of the Second World War. And Jill has done a fantastic job, Jill Golding, in tracking what happened to her grandfather, and she's got plaques and memorials now put up in Hayling Island, which is a lovely part of, you know, sort of nice beachy area where this training took place on the south coast of England. And she's done a sterling job in investigating what happened to her father because nobody wanted to tell her. In fact, in her own family, even her own mother didn't want to say anything about it. And it was only when she died that Jill went in to clear the house out. She found up in the loft an old suitcase with a whole load of top secret documents in from her grandfather. And then she started thinking, good God, he was involved in this and this. He got a DSO, Distinguished Service. It's just like the biggest medal of the war. He did more operations against the enemy coast, occupied France and Belgium and Holland than anybody else in the war. Right. So he was a total war hero, but he was sacrificed because he wasn't happy about what had been done with his men. That's at least the conclusion Jill and I have come to over the years about the secrecy of this operation. It also shows you how ruthless the higher-ups are or were in covering up their own treachery. And it really is. That's what it is. It's treachery. You've used that war to get a load of money to finance an enormously powerful Nazi mafia after the war, you know, which is in cooperation with Zionists now to create another world war. So the big corporations, of course, they are much more powerful in many ways than governments. Look at Big Pharma. Big Pharma has bought up the law and policy, both in Britain and in the United States, they are very, very much in the driving seat. You've got to be an extremely good MP to stop their programs for dominating the medical profession. And, you know, and if you do, you're too successful, you might find yourself either booted out like someone like Andrew Wakefield, the doctor who has been so much of a campaigner around criticizing multiple vaccines. You know, he's not against vaccination per se. He's saying this is killing people. The way you're using these vaccines, multiple vaccines, including hepatitis B, which you can only catch through injecting in the needle or, you know, or various sorts of peculiar sex. You're injecting that into a newborn child. Why does it need it? It doesn't need it. And he's pointing these things out. And of course, he's, you know, so anyway, the government should be there representing us to defend people like Wakefield. Of course, it's not, because there's a much bigger program going on. And this is where we come to now, is we seem to have, Will, this kind of idea that we've all got to go around wearing face masks and God knows what else until there's a vaccine. And then once you get the vaccine, which I don't want, I'm not having it, I'm not interested. I think I've already had this COVID-19 anyway. Back in the end of December, I had all the symptoms of it. And why should I want a vaccine? My immune system is pretty good. You know, I'd rather my immune system copes with this stuff. So I'm going to make a choice and have informed consent not to have it. And yet they're saying that if I don't have this little ID 2020 certificate, you know, which who knows, maybe will eventually become a microchip that's in my hand I can use to buy and sell and God knows what. Who knows what's going to happen with that? But anyway, for now, it's just a kind of ID 2020 certificate. You know, it just shows me that the Nazi spirit is alive and well and thriving in Big Pharma, and it's telling our governments what to do, and our governments don't know what is going on. I mean, all the policies that they brought in all seem way too late. You know, certainly looking at what's happened in Britain, I don't really know what the situation is in the United States, but they've really only started testing as the pandemic is kind of fizzling out. So it's keeping the figures up, you know, so loads more people are getting tested. So, oh, there's more people with the virus. Well, hang on, no, there's more people being tested, yeah? Not necessarily got it. The other thing they've done consistently is massively inflated the number of people who are actually dying of COVID-19 simply by saying that anyone that's died with it or without actually being tested, they've got symptoms that relate to it, they are going to be, it's going to be down on their death certificate, and they're going to be introduced to the public on the TV news of dying of COVID-19. No, they died with COVID-19 and they had underlying health conditions. And that doesn't mean they died of it. Sorry. But there's been an enormous amount of censorship, as you know. And so I think we're now living with the legacy of not actually doing the job in World War II. We never actually finished off the Nazis. And with the dirty deal that Rockefeller did with the Israelis, they didn't want to finish off the Nazis, even though, you know, the Holocaust was killing so many of their own compatriots, the Jewish people. They didn't really seem to care that much about it. They were much more interested in setting up their own state. And so we're now in a situation where we're living with the failure to deal with the Nazis at the end of the Second World War. And there's all sorts of people responsible for that. But there are also a whole bunch, Will, who, you know, like myself, who have over the years been trying to make sure that this is not dropped. Yeah, that the idea that you can just loot the whole of Europe and use that to finance a totally crooked, evil financial Fourth Reich, which wants to start the next war in order to make more money and get more power from that. Well, I'm sorry, guys, you're going to have a fight on your hands.
Absolutely. And, you know, just to back you up, too, I mean, NASA was created off Wernher von Braun, the V-2 rocketry. Operation Paperclip has been fully declassified. They even talk about it in freaking Captain America movies now. It's completely mainstream. We took all of these Nazis over. And just to kind of round things up a little bit, too, I mean, this is a big question, so take your time with it. It's multifaceted, as all my annoying questions are. But so you're telling me right now that World War II didn't end. The good guys, you know, America didn't end in freedom and the British Empire. We didn't just go marching hand by hand. So we also have connected to the Bilderberg Group as well, too. Because the Bilderberg Group.
Let's talk about Bilderberg in a minute. But when you say World War II didn't finish, well, it did. 1945, but World War III started straight away, really. And this is a quote, actually, from a guy called Vincenzo Vinciguerra. He was a fascist terrorist working as part of the Gladio Network in Europe. In the 1990s, he was interviewed by Alan Frankovich, who did the training at LA Film School, and then was almost certainly bumped off at Houston Airport in the customs hall. But he did a film called On Company Business, all about the CIA, which is a brilliant film. And then he did a series of three films for the BBC Time Watch, which went out in 1993, looking at Operation Gladio. The only thing I think we know now that isn't in those films, so that's another definite tip if you're interested, watch those films, is that the Gladio units, which were these terrorist units, part of NATO intelligence, which were blowing up ordinary civilians in Europe and killing people in supermarkets, attacking police stations, they were all controlled by NATO. And through things like the P2 Lodge in Italy, the fascist Licio Gelli controlling this, the parallel government of Italy, which was funded by the CIA and others. But, you know, the Gladio networks were basically straight out of the Nazi playbook, because at the end of the war, they had these werewolf units, which were behind enemy lines as the Allied troops came in and the Russians came in. I think it was more the Allied side for some reason. But they would be like sort of guerrilla units operating behind the lines, and all the same sort of tactics of those, these stay-behind forces, were picked up by NATO and used against ordinary civilians in Italy, in Belgium, and some would say Northern Ireland as well, in order to get people scared and worried about the Russian communists, that they were communists who were doing this. Actually, it was basically red or left-wing groups which were a bit hot-headed, but they were basically controlled by NATO got their arms and their weapons and everything from NATO, and they had like professional mercenaries like Vinciguerra. So that's what he said in the film, in the Gladio film. It's a brilliant interview with him in Frankovich did in a prison in Italy, where he just said, oh well, in 1945 World War finished and World War III began. And he's saying basically he and us, we were part of that World War III. And, you know, so there's lots and lots in that. But you said, yes, about Bilderberg, very important. I mean, we go back to the Red House meeting in August 1944 I was talking about. You've got there a very interesting deal being done, right? So this is the beginnings of the big deals for the end of the war with the Allies, between Bormann and the Allies. And, you know, basically getting all of the German industry in line to understand what is that deal and what are we going to do after the war. So they were moving all of their money out into offshore accounts, into foreign branches of their own businesses, the German businesses, ready for this coordinated effort by Bormann. But then there was a parachute drop in September, the one month after this Red House meeting, at Arnhem. And this was a supposed masterstroke. It was in the film A Bridge Too Far. And a whole load of stuff about it in that film. It's, I think, a 2.5-hour film which explains the Battle of Arnhem. And these paratroopers went in, the 82nd Airborne Division, 101st Airborne Division, and the British 1st Airborne Division, to capture these bridges, to do a bridgehead over the Rhine. The idea was to get into, this is in September 1944, get straight into the Ruhr to close down the Nazis' industrial capacity, just like that. Anyway, it's quite clear now that Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was a former SS officer, he was given some sort of security clearance, amazingly, by the British Army, although the Royal Navy wouldn't, and the American Army wouldn't give him any security. They didn't trust him at all. He then sent an agent, a guy called King Kong, in, 4 or 5 days before the paratroop battle, to basically just tell the Germans exactly what was coming. In fact, now we've even got the Enigma decrypts to say, oh, look, the Germans are chit-chatting. Oh, the British are coming, you know, in a few days' time, the parachutes are going to be dropping around here, you know. So they knew we were coming because it had all been given away by Prince Bernhard, this wonderful guy who used to be an SS officer. He married into the Dutch royal family just before the war, and so he was saying, oh, no, I'm Dutch, I'm not German. And then maybe he just didn't mention or didn't show the photographs of him in his Nazi uniform, you know. Anyway, so that Prince Bernhard then went on after the war. So the whole thing was sabotaged, basically, by Bernhard and by a particular British officer who was unbelievably incompetent. It was quite clear he knew what was going on. His name was General Boy Browning, and he steered the American General Gavin during that battle. He said, well, don't bother with the bridge. Yeah. You're supposed to be taking this. Your main objective is to take the bridge. He said, oh, don't bother about the bridge. Let's go up to these hills nearby. You know, let's take everybody. And this American general was telling him, are you sure, sir? You know, and anyway, so that meant that the Germans could capture this bridge and hold it so that when the armored column came up, they were stuck basically in Nijmegen. But anyway, the Americans, Moffat Burrows that I interviewed as well, he was one of the soldiers there, a captain in the 82nd Airborne Division. He explains how he managed to get across with a whole load of his men. They went on a load of little boats across the river. They captured the other end of the bridge. And he went up to the British soldier who was Lord Carrington, right? So we had so far Bernhard, who became a Bilderberg chairman. Carrington, sitting in his tank at the bridge, also was a Bilderberg chairman for a while. He was a British foreign secretary as well. So he was sitting in his tank, and Burris brought his Tommy gun against this guy's head and said, get down that road to Arnhem. Your guys are hurting down there. There's nothing there. What are you doing? And they sat around, he's twiddling his thumbs. And in fact, Carrington then got into his tank, right? Because he's got this massive armoured column. He's got hundreds of, as Burris just saw, they've got a corps of tanks that could have won this battle, but they didn't. Carrington just sat there in his tank at Nijmegen. And Moffat Burrows, who just lost half his men capturing the bridge, got so angry with him, he pointed his Tommy gun at Carrington, and Carrington actually got into his tank and put the hatch down, right? Wound the hatch down and battled in, so he's sitting in there, I'm not going anywhere, right? And that meant that they only started moving forward towards Arnhem once the final British had been wiped out from the 1st Airborne at the bridge. I also interviewed Tony Hibbert, who's the brigade major in the, I think it's the 2nd Battalion, the 1st Airborne Division, who was holding Arnhem Bridge. Right, so anyway, the upshot of all of this is a complete sabotage, right, of this brilliant, potentially brilliant military operation by the British, by Boy Browning particularly, by the British sending Bernhard, trusting him with all the information that he then told the Germans, and also by Carrington. So you've got a whole load of people here involved in sabotaging this operation. So this was the big in-joke for Bilderberg. And as the British were surrounded in Arnhem and they were being attacked by Germans with rockets, tanks, and God knows what, these are paratroopers. They haven't got lightly armed guys, you know, so they're being massacred. At the time, it was nicknamed the Witch's Cauldron, right? Because as soon as you moved, you were dead, basically. You had to hide. They ran out of water as well. So they were drinking water. I've been over there, right? I'm chatting to some people who've heard these stories directly from the people involved. The British soldiers in Arnhem were drinking the water from the radiators, because they had nothing to drink. They were draining the radiators, opening the radiators and the houses up and trying to drink the water out of them. So it was a horrendous situation. Eventually they were evacuated across the river. But this was the big in-joke of Bilderberg. The big in-joke was, the Witch's Cauldron, we got you there, you were sabotaged, and the Nazis were given that extra few months in order to hide and squirrel their wealth away. So that's effectively what we're talking about here. Yeah. So that's why Bilderberg happened in that same exact spot, in the Witch's Cauldron, 10 years after the war, the very first ever Bilderberg meeting. And what did I say? Prince Bernhard was the guy who betrayed the British and the Americans there at that battle. And he was the one who was chosen to chair the first 20 years of Bilderberg conferences, and a whole load of particularly nasty Nazis whose pasts are now known but weren't in the 1950s and 1960s were at those first Bilderberg meetings. So it's basically a Nazi organization. Effectively, this is an organization which, you know, now this year has decided it's not meeting. Well, of course it's meeting. It's probably just a steering group. It's just not public. It's just gone underground. They'll be out there somewhere. It's just that nobody's supposed to know where they are. There's going to be no protest, and the whole thing has gone into lockdown mode and total secrecy mode. But they're most definitely out there still and plotting and planning. I mean, effectively, they think of themselves as so rich and powerful. Met some of these guys, Will, as so rich and powerful that they just control the world. They control the politicians. The Bilderberg conferences themselves are like kind of horse trading fairs where they look at all these politicians that are up and coming and they say, oh, this guy's good. We'll go for him. We'll buy him. And that's the way the world is run nowadays, the Western world anyway. Yeah, China isn't obviously part of it, but they're controlled by triads and secret societies and Henry Kissinger. And the US is controlled largely through Freemasonry, and Britain is Freemasonry too. So you've got, effectively, you've got the two big protagonists in a potential Third World War, all controlled by Henry Kissinger. So that's why I say Kissinger, who's always at these Bilderberg conferences, if you really want to know where it's taking place, just follow him. You know, if he's not at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, he'll be at the Bilderberg conference last weekend or the weekend before, you know, or maybe even this, possibly this coming weekend. It's always around this time of year. And so it's lovely for you to ask me to do this. I know it's a long interview, but this is my sort of offering this year for explaining why Bilderberg is still so important and why its roots are absolutely grounded in the Nazi operation. And many of these people, including Winston Churchill, knew exactly what was going on. He was very close to Morton. And obviously he wrote a letter to John Ainsworth Davis. And I'll just finish by just giving you a quote from somebody who was very, very a good guy. His name is Dennis Wheatley. He's also a writer like Ian Fleming. He's probably the person that advised Fleming to write to get the alcoholism out of his system, the nasty stuff out of his system. And he was a writer before the war and after the war. He's definitely worth reading. Pretty much everything Dennis Wheatley ever wrote is worth reading. He's been completely buried by history. But, you know, I'll finish with a little quote from him. Because he's very much in the know about a lot of this stuff. He was one of the psychological warfare officers, or deception planners, they called them, during the Second World War. And in his book, The Devil and All His Works, which was published by Hutchinson in 1971, Wheatley says, "It's been said that as a young man, Winston Churchill was a member of the Illuminati of Adam Weishaupt. In view of his tirelessly inquiring mind, it would not be very surprising if that were so." So Wheatley is hinting, Illuminati. I actually went to Chartwell, which is where Churchill lived.
What was it called?
Huh?
What was it called?
The quote is from a book called The Devil and All His Works, and it's Dennis Wheatley hinting very strongly that Winston Churchill was a member of the Illuminati. And he was working with Churchill right through the war in the war cabinet. You know, so at Chartwell, where Churchill lived, which, by the way, he moved into after Desmond Morton brought a house down the road, right? So they were only about half an hour, 40 minutes walk away from each other. But Churchill moved, it looks like, to be close to Morton rather than the other way around. At Chartwell, I mean, this is one of the most bizarre things about it all. Is that Wheatley was, I think, you know, one of the people who was really, really on the inside track on a lot of this. But there was a little gypsy that lived up on the hill right next to Churchill's place. And everybody, after the war, everyone knew, well, this was where all the messages were going, the secret ones that no one was supposed to know about. It'd be someone would go up, like someone like John Ainsworth Davis, and hand the gypsy a little note, and then it would disappear, you know. So this is all in the OpJB book. But at Chartwell, I went around visiting it recently. It's a very great place to go to if anyone's visiting Britain. It's just into Kent. It's not open during COVID, but it will be soon, I imagine, with all the face masks and God knows what else, paraphernalia. But I asked him, I said, was Winston Churchill a Freemason? I said to the guide, oh, no, nonsense. And I said, well, how do you know? And he looked blankly, because there was a whole load of other visitors at the same time. There was sort of chuckles went around. And he carried on his talk, right? And then I said, well, look, yes, he was. Look, you don't know what you're talking about. I said to the guide, and there was a picture on my phone of a Daily Mail article saying, here's all Winston Churchill's Masonic paraphernalia is up for sale at Christie's, you know. So they're in denial, you know, but Freemasonry is all over this stuff. And as we know, Churchill and Stalin and Roosevelt were all Masons. And it just seemed to me that this is effectively a kind of witchcraft system with these blood oaths, with these cults that enable these wars to take place. And I don't think it's wrong to say that at the back of this, it's satanic, you know, it's evil. The COVID, what's happened, this is a man-made thing. We just have Richard Dearlove from MI6, a Bilderberger, saying this is definitely man-made. He says it's China, but I say no, not necessarily. Maybe it's British. Maybe it's American. You know, so evil is abroad. If someone has released this COVID virus deliberately for geopolitical purposes or as a way of getting a war started with China or whatever, you know, maybe the Chinese government know, but they're not saying because they don't want a war. And eventually what is going to happen is the war is going to transpire, isn't it? And all the truth is going to come out, Will. That's what it seems to me anyway.
You're absolutely right. And I'm very, again, appreciative that you came on here to talk about this because it's something that fascinates me personally. And I think you did a really good job of laying out the fact that we have, you know, whether you want to say World War II stopped and World War III started immediately, we do have this uninterrupted line of Nazis in control of power. We still have Donald Trump sending Wilbur Ross and Jared Kushner to the Bilderberg Group. This group was created by Nazis. We have Tony Blair going there 1 year, next year he's running England. Same thing with Bill Clinton. Same thing with Merkel. Same thing with Macron, who was a Rothschild banker. And I definitely want to ask you one more question because I teased it at the beginning of this video, and I know you've been very gracious at your time with your time. And I want to have you back on to talk about Freemasonry, Satanism. What is Satanism? You know. But you're going to only hear awesome stuff like this here on Demand the Truth. No makeup. No teleprompters, no corporate sponsors, no big farmer, no warmongering. We're not covering up for pedophile rings or anything like that. So like, share, subscribe. All of his information is going to be here. Is Hitler alive? Is he still alive? Or not maybe now, but did he survive the war?
We'll do it in a minute, but I think I should clarify. The link between witchcraft and Freemasonry is through the oaths. If you have a look at the oaths that they swear, it's identical oaths. You know, so the idea really is that witchcraft was banned, you know, and the idea is that you are loyal not to anyone else, but you're loyal to the cult. And this is absolutely pernicious. I don't think that this should be allowed, not in civil society, let alone in public office. You know, it's completely...
And that's the thing, I will see people all the time in public service, whether they're cops or other people that work for the state, and I'll see a Freemasonic ring. And I'll ask them, hey, do you take your oath to the Constitution more seriously or your oath to Freemasonry? And I have yet to get an answer on that. And I've asked several times.
Because the answer is the cult has the power of death over them. You know, they've basically willingly given up the power to kill me over to the cult. And so quite clearly, they're going to do what the cult says. And this shouldn't be allowed. And this is why I think Freemasonry is really just a, you know, it's a cover for what in medieval times was, you know, considered completely abhorrent and, you know, obviously completely against God. You know, the idea here is that man is in charge. Man is going to be the all-seeing eye, you know, surveillance and God knows what else. These guys haven't got our best interests at heart. I think we need to wise up to that pretty quick. But anyway, about Adolf Hitler, there's film of his dead body, filmed by the Soviet army, the Red Army. You can, I think, still see that on the internet. He was a broken man. Bormann was all great guns, and I would suggest even in the bunker, it might even have been simply Bormann that shot and killed Hitler rather than him committing suicide, because he was on a mission, he knew, to survive the war and to carry on Hitler's, and he took Hitler's will with him, which is published in, I think it's in Paul Manning's book, it is Hitler's Will. Certainly in one of those books I mentioned today, and he was entrusted with carrying on the fight, and Hitler had given up the fight at that point. He was actually broken psychologically and physically. He was extremely ill. He was on various drugs, and they did a very good job in covering it up, because there was the so-called body of Bormann, which was found in Berlin. Well, supposedly found, but that was left deliberately, and OpJB describes it. They got a guy who looked like Bormann. They altered his teeth before he went on the mission. He didn't know what he was really there to do. And then he was killed in Berlin and his body was left there. And that's the body they found. And in fact, the real Bormann, apparently, according to John Ainsworth Davis, even popped a little cyanide pill into his mouth as he was dying. So that when they found the body, they think, oh, this guy is Bormann and he's committed suicide, you know. And that was one of the things that came out. So the two big occasions where Bormann's body was supposedly found in Berlin. Number one was in 1972 when Stuart Stephen released this Daily Express report saying we found Bormann in South America. So then this big sledgehammer that comes in to crush the truth, you know. And then again, when John Ainsworth Davis's book was published in the 1990s, there was another so-called DNA discovery. Oh, it's definitely Bormann, you know, forget all this stuff about him surviving. So And also in the 90s is when all this literature, like the Grey Wolf literature about Hitler surviving the war, completely fictitious, also came out to cover the truth about Martin Bormann surviving, saying, oh, Hitler's around. You know, this is absolute nonsense, and it's deliberate misinformation. A bit like, you know, there's no planes at the Twin Towers, you know. There was no plane at the Pentagon, actually, not the Twin Towers. This is psychological warfare, deliberate disinformation in order to just completely confuse you. If you start to look at it, and if you don't look deeply into it enough, all happens is you understand nothing about it at all. So that's why all this Hitler stuff has come out, to obscure the truth about Bormann.
Well, crazy interview, and now I have not only just more questions, but also entire new interviews that we're going to need to do. We're going to need to tackle 9/11, because I've been also thinking about that a lot lately. I honestly, up until even last night, literally last night, I'm still not sure that a plane hit the Pentagon, you know, but I do understand some of the DNA evidence, which is interesting. But, you know, it's really tough. So that's going to be an incredible episode. So hopefully you'll come on and we'll discuss Satan and the Freemasonry Templars, 9/11.
There's a lot of similarities between 9/11 and this COVID, I think. A tremendous number. It's enormous amount of censorship going on. Disinformation. The media is being used to bamboozle us. I mean, the best thing to do is just switch your television off and maybe share with your friends a few trusted channels. Because there is an enormous mind control operation going on here. Yes, there is a virus, but no, it's not much more than a bad flu. It really isn't. And we don't need to go and put masks on everywhere. This is just Bill Gates trying to get his agenda. And of course, he, by the way, is another version of Rockefeller. Okay, so he's the big monopolist of the late 20th century and the early 21st century, with Microsoft taking over all of our IT everywhere, in exactly the same way as John D. Rockefeller did with Standard Oil, taking over the whole oil industry. Well, now it's IT. Look at Bilderberg. It's gone from the bankers have always been there, but it's gone from the big oil companies. Mostly it's big, it's the tech giants at Bilderberg now. So they want to control social media. They want to control any alternative to the mainstream media. And they're doing reasonably well. Google, for example, its searches are hopeless now, complete waste of time. If you're looking for anything useful, Google, forget it. Absolutely useless. You will not find, even if you put the exact search term in what you're looking for, Google will hide it from you. And so these are the people we need to be concerned about now. They are the monopolists and the mind controllers, the same way as people, exact same way as people like Joseph Goebbels were in the Second World War, and they are doing the censorship. You know, the Nazis were doing the censorship in the Second World War. A point I try and make as often as possible is that the British didn't censor the Nazi propaganda. We had a guy called Lord Haw Haw writing to the Brits, broadcasting from Radio Luxembourg every night to Britain. They never jammed it. They just let everyone listen to it. And then on the BBC, there would be a sort of program taking the mickey, satirizing Lord Haw Haw. You know, so this idea of censorship is a Nazi idea. This idea of stifling free speech, the free speech of expert opinion, crushing that, destroying any kind of balance in the mainstream press, that's a Nazi idea. It's not from the West. It shouldn't be the sort of thing we do. So, you know, we've got a struggle on our hands, and it's going to be a bit of a rocky road, I think, in the future. Yeah. Ultimately, though, they can't win. They can't win. It's just a question of how many of us they're going to take down on the way.
Exactly. And for the folks at home not to be accountable for how many extra people they bring down, it's really on you. Tony can go out there. He can go pour through the research. He can read it. He can research it. He can transmit it. But it ultimately goes up to the viewers to share this. As he just talked about, we talked about on this channel a million times, we're shadow banned. We're demonetized. We're not getting the information out here. So the only way it works is if you guys go ahead and do this.
That's right. And I mean, I've been kicked off of, I've been doing a radio show for 12 years. I was trained by the BBC to do it. And I've just been booted off because of my views. I imagine because of what we did with the COVID. We exposed that COVID was man-made in the first week of February from several reports, one Russian report and an Indian report, which were absolutely 100% scientific, credible, saying that this is very unlikely that this is natural. And that, then we've only just 4 months later had that officially announced by Richard Dearlove from MI6. And it started to be talked about in the Telegraph. The BBC won't mention it. So the only way you're going to get this information is by, you know, hanging on and listening to, you know, dogged old style journalists like me, I'm afraid. The big boys are never going to tell you what you need to know.
Yes, they've all sacrificed themselves, their souls. And that's why it's so important to support people like Tony. All of his information will be here in the description. Share this information. Go on email, text message, Facebook. This guy, he didn't sacrifice his soul. He sacrificed his career and his livelihood. People have died for doing things like this. And he said, you know what? You can kill me. You can do whatever you want, but I'm going to keep my balls, my spirit intact. I'm going to do the right thing. I'm going to put my life online for you. He's like, you know, I'm not going to wear makeup. I'm not going to shill for big pharma. I'm not going to go for people that lie about weapons of mass destruction, babies in incubators, cover up pedophile rings like Jeffrey Epstein. And then on top of all that, you know, they're going to try to give you Bill Gates information, who gave $2 million to Jeffrey Epstein after he was caught raping kids. So, Tony, it was an honor and a pleasure as always. Looking forward to hopefully speaking to you again soon. We got so many topics to discuss. And please, guys, it relies on you for doing this. Tony, I know it's late there. You have a great evening. And look forward to talking to you soon. Will Turba here. Demand the truth. You're only going to get it here, guys. Fake Mike. Real news. Like, share, and subscribe. Tony's information is right here. Share it, guys. Good night, folks.